You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, at least one U.S. senator is calling for American military intervention in Venezuela. Coming up, we'll discuss the latest on what's happening there and how the U.S. has been involved militarily and otherwise with previous Latin American conflicts. Now, the part of the country we live in here is often described by those looking in from the outside as insular, provincial, simple, maybe unsophisticated, even worse, flyover country. Our next guest spent her life on both coasts before taking a job teaching at a university in what is often referred to as the heartland. And she quickly realized that the assumptions and expectations that she brought with her didn't match up to the reality or history of her new home. Kristen Hogenson is professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Her most recent book is called The Heartland and American History. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, Rob, it is such a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, this idea of the heartland and heartland values, when you start to think about it, it's hard to pin down. And it turns out, looking at your book, that's probably because people have meant a lot of different things by it over the years. Could you try to get a handle on it for us?
Right. So the heartland, I think, is often understood through the lens of stereotype and myth. And the leading assumptions that characterize the heartland myth about what the center of the country is like hold that it is profoundly local. And I'm speaking specifically of the rural heartland, which is seen as the, you know, the core of the stereotypical heartland, that is profoundly local, insular, isolated, provincial, and indeed as a place that can be regarded as the ultimate national safe space. So I tackled those ideas in my book and, in fact, end up turning them quite inside out.
Right. The whole book, you're kind of looking from your backyard, basically, in your part of Illinois, and looking at a history that is really not static or isolated or insular. We'll dig into some of the details, but, I mean, in a lot of ways, what we call the heartland is really a crossroads of global activity.
Right. So instead of seeing it as being in the middle of nowhere, I think people on the ground know quite well that it is in many respects in the middle of everywhere, that being in the middle of a major landmass hasn't cut it off from the rest of the world. And in fact, if you look at things like borderlands histories between the U.S. and Canada and U.S. and Mexico, if you try to get a handle on where borderlands peter out, one of the places where you can look is in the Midwest, where they actually have come together historically, and people in the middle of the country have border brokers brokered borders, north and south simultaneously due to their position in the middle.
And a lot of times we hear today and in the past the idea that especially that small town part of the Midwest, what people think of as, you know, Main Street, real America gets thrown around, heartland also does, as this place, it's been the same for a long time. And only now, whenever the now is that we're talking about, is it encountering this change. It's getting roped into the world for better or worse, depending on who you're talking to. But it's always been like that. We've always been at that that intersection between what we think is the static, what we have here, and this changing world.
Exactly. So that is a major point of the book. So it is a history account, and the time period that I cover starts in the early 19th century and goes through World War I. Which is typically thought of as a profoundly local time, that it's the years between what are widely recognized is years of profound contact, which by which I'm referring to the colonial era, and then the 20th century rise of U.S. global power post-World War I, and the recognition that the United States has been deeply intertwined with the world as a whole since the mid-20th century. So I look at the time that's typically considered to be the most local time in U.S. history. And one of the places that is generally conceived of as the most local places. And I find that even if you stretch back and do the long backstory of the modern Midwest, it has always been shaped by histories of mobility and connection. So, for example, if you start with the indigenous people who lived in central Illinois, which is the place I take as the starting point of my story, they were highly mobile over long periods of time and also seasonally, staying in villages in the warmer months to plant and then in the colder months traveling quite widely. And then subsequently, when the settler colonists or pioneers settled the state, they were people who by definition came from somewhere else. You know, that is the meaning of pioneer, somebody who is a newcomer. And they continue to travel quite widely for business, to relocate to other places, in many cases further west, to serve in the military. The Midwest has historically been a hotbed of missionary production, so vast kind of global networks through missionary activities. And in terms of just, you know, the economy of the rural Midwest, for many years, the bedrock of the economy was agricultural. It still continues to be very important in the Midwest. And export markets have always been profoundly important to farmers. From the beginning, they had absolutely no intention of being self-sufficient. They were always ambitious for global markets and were an aggressive foreign policy constituency for expansionist policies starting in the 19th century.
We're talking to Kristen Hoganson. Her most recent book is The Heartland and American History. Kristen, I want to dig into each of those time periods a little deeper. You were talking about the Kickapoo who were here and the settlers. And people think of native removal. They might think of the Trail of Tears further south. You say the Midwest, tragically, was the frontier where that happened for many years, decades.
Yeah, so as somebody who teaches the U.S. History Survey and has used a number of textbooks over the year, the core story is the Cherokee story and the horrific story of the Trail of Tears. And I think it's very important that we all know that story, but it's also important that we recognize that it's not the only story and that the Midwest has its own horrific and heart-wrenching stories of Indian removal. Histories of ethnic cleansing, in essence, that predate and then continued alongside the histories that are more familiar to us from the Southeast. And let me just tell you a little bit more about the Kickapoo history, in part because Kickapoos did have a tribal presence in Wisconsin as well as Illinois. That at the time of Columbus, most Kickapoos lived in what is now the Detroit, Michigan, and Windsor, Ontario area. But because of the violence that followed from the fur trade, they, in many cases, relocated further south in Michigan, further west. They went to Indiana, to Illinois, to Wisconsin. And then upon being forced out of the states where they had relocated, upon being forced out in the early 19th century, many went further to the southwest, including to Mexico, where they established a tribal presence. And indeed, there are, to this day, Kickapoo people living in Mexico, as well as in the Eagle Pass, Texas area, who are, in essence, exiled Midwesterners by virtue of their ancestry and family connections.
And then bring it to the next part of the, to another part of the story you were talking about. I mean, today, probably literally today in Wisconsin, we have farmers, dairy farmers often talking about tariffs and how they're affecting them, how much access they're going to have to sell their goods in other countries, Canada, Europe, you name it. You write, people were having exactly that conversation in the late 1800s, 1930s, you name it. This has been a long running concern.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's something that often gets lost in outside conversations about the Midwest. I think that the Midwest is often perceived by people on the coast as an undifferentiated region. And a lot of attention is paid to the deindustrialized Midwest and the job losses and wall building impulses that emanate from places that have lost good jobs to offshore production and to imports from other parts of the world. And I think in those discussions, the real significant global trade connections of the agricultural sector disappear from wider public conversations. But of course, people who are agricultural producers in the Midwest know very well how important export markets have been and how important initiatives such as NAFTA and trade agreements have been for gaining greater markets, and just how painful some of the recent trade war impacts have been.
And another interesting story you tell is how American pigs were not in favor in the British Empire, and it was a key turning point in our economy when I think it was the British Navy finally said, you know, these pork products, they're okay for our sailors.
Yeah, I just love this story. It was so unexpected when I stumbled across the history of the Berkshire pig. I could go on, actually, for hours and hours about it, but I know I don't have that much time. But the point is the pioneers brought pigs with them, but they were nasty, savage animals that could survive on their own in the woods, fend for themselves, jump over fences and so forth. And they weren't very profitable. And the farmers of the Midwest wanted to reach more lucrative markets. For a while, they just relied on river routes to ship their pork products downstream. But that meant feeding the low-end markets of the plantation south in the Caribbean. And what they really wanted were the high-end, lucrative markets of Europe. And they realized that to access them, they had to have a better pork product. And that led them to invest in blooded lines of pigs. And the most popular pig for a while in the 19th century was the Berkshire hog. And as you mentioned, part of his ancestry came from the ships of empire, from the British Navy, brought back to England, to Berkshire County, where they were crossbred with English pigs and produced this just unprecedented kind of a line of hogs that matured early, marbled nicely, fattened quickly. And it became all the rage in the United States, enabling farmers to produce a more competitive pork product, which then they were able to sell to the lucrative markets of Europe, primarily to Britain. And then the meat from the British ancestry pigs ended up feeding the British military, feeding British emigrants to places like New Zealand and Australia on those long-distance trips, and producing more emigration because British farmers were outcompeted and many of them ended up becoming settler colonists, moving to places like Canada, the United States, Australia, South Africa, New Zealand.
We're talking to Kristen Hoganson about her latest book. It's called The Heartland, an American History. She's a professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She looks at what is thought of often as isolated, small town, middle America, and she traces over time its incredible connections to the global economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does the term heartland mean to you when we're talking about the United States? Is it all positive? Are there some negative aspects as well? Do you think that people from outside the Midwest get a lot wrong about our region if they think of us as backwards, disconnected? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Kristen Hoganson, professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about her latest book. It's called The Heartland in American History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you lived in the Midwest all your life, or did you move here? Did you find things that changed your expectations about what it meant to be in the Midwest, especially in the smaller town parts of the state or the region? What do you find that people get right or wrong about the Midwest? Call in at 800-642-1234. And if you've got a family history that goes back five, six generations, whatever the case may be, what have you seen change in your family? What have you seen stay the same over the generations? Call 800-642-1234. We'll bring out a caller now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Mark?
Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that I am also a University of Illinois graduate. But just last night, I was reading an article. We're talking about transplanting people. I was reading an article where during the Depression, they took farmers from northern Wisconsin, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, Minnesota, those who were used to the cold weather, and they were transplanted to help settle Alaska in the area of now Portage, which is just north of Anchorage. And my wife and I are planning a trip there this summer. And in the process of researching that trip, I discovered that. I thought it was pretty interesting.
Interesting. You might find a community of former Wisconsinites there. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us. Do you see that the Kickapoo you mentioned, Kristen, moved into the area and were forced back out of the area? Do we see European immigrants coming in and then staging from the Midwest to other parts of the country, as Mark said, to Alaska in that case?
Yeah, so that fits into a much longer pattern. So what tended to happen with a number of pioneers is they had a lot of children. And as land became more expensive, it became difficult for every child to get a farm that would be sufficient to have, you know, a good standard of living. And so they became a really active group of people looking to colonize places further west in places like Indian territory, think Oklahoma. and also in Canada. So there were a number of advertisements in Midwestern newspapers for land seekers excursions to places like Saskatchewan and Manitoba and Alberta. So there is a long history of Midwesterners moving even farther afield over the course of the long 19th century.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. He mentioned seeing old news articles about this, Kristen. That's one of the things I love about your book. You included just a lot of the archival things you ran across, some directly relevant to what you're talking about, some just interesting points of history in the Champaign area of Illinois. Can you talk about hunting and finding some of those?
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned the archival traces. So this book could have been thousands of pages long. I mean, there were just so many leads that I did not have a chance to track down, and it was really hard to let go of them. So I have at the start of each chapter just a couple little snippets from different sources that are just really suggestive about things like monarch butterflies or selling exotic birds door to door that have stories behind them, but I just didn't have a chance to fully pursue the stories. A lot of my research was in local history archives. I also benefited profoundly from recent digitization efforts to take small-scale local newspapers and make them available electronically, which meant that I could keyword search for things. And then I got hits that I never would have found if I had just spent years and years and years going through microfilm reels page by page. So one of the things that I researched was the idea of flyover states, and I was interested in what that meant, right, to be on the ground looking up at the sky and thinking about, aerial connections. And so that led me to things like tracking down bird migrations, which were very important to farmers who relied on birds for pest control before synthetic pesticides. And I'm typing in all these words about birds and sky and so forth, and I start getting all these hits for UFOs, which I never would have found otherwise. And it's because long-distance balloon races in the early 19th century tended to take off from the Midwest, and that's because the balloonists didn't want to go down over water.
Fair.
And so then people living in small towns in the middle of the night would see lights in the sky and hear noises overhead and report UFOs that then made it into the newspapers as, these flying spaceships in the night.
We're talking to Kristen Hoganson about her new book, The Heartland in American History. I want to bring on another caller now. Phil is with us in Appleton. Hi, Phil.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Phil?
Well, I just want to tell Kristen I lived about most of my life about 12 miles south of the University of Illinois, down at the base of the Glacial Moraine, just a little bit northwest of Longview. And his drain swamp, my grandpa helped drain it, and I've been a nature observer all my life because there wasn't any telephone in there when I was a youngster, and it was pretty basic, so I've got a lot of nice things to share with her. Can't do it on the show. I'll do some other time.
Oh, that would be great.
Phil, thanks a lot for the call. He mentioned draining the swamp. Can you talk a little bit about how dramatically the landscape changed, maybe from one period to another, in a region like your part of the heartland there?
Oh, right. So that was another astounding thing I discovered. The wet prairie was called the wet prairie for a reason. It was really, really, really wet. And the part of the state that I live in and take as a starting point for my story was basically swamp until the pioneers came. And then they needed to separate land from water to be able to plant things like corn. And so they embarked on major engineering works. In which they dug ditches, and then they laid tiles beneath the soil that fast-tracked the water into the ditches and then ultimately to the Mississippi and down to the Gulf of Mexico. They laid millions of tiles in Illinois, enough to circle the earth six times if laid end-to-end. So we're talking about some of the most significant engineering works in U.S. history that most people don't know about because they're not visible from, say, the sky if you're in an airplane looking down at flyover state, or indeed if you're just driving across the landscape or the countryside, they're not visible to the eye. But nonetheless, they're there and have massively transformed the ecology of the region, turning it into one of the richest sites of agricultural production in the world today.
That's a fine point to maybe just spend a couple minutes on to hammer home the point you're making. We associate farmland scenery with Wisconsin and Illinois and our neighboring states. It feels natural in a way, But this thing we take for granted was the consequence of, as you said, one of the biggest engineering projects in the country. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, to go beyond engineering, it's bigger than that, right? We're talking about a history of massive biological transformation. So I live in the prairie state, or the so-called prairie state, and yet less than 0.1% of Illinois is native tall grass prairie now. And that is only in part because of urbanization, that most of it is because of the purposeful introduction of new biological material. And we can see that now on massive scales. If you're looking down from the sky in the fields of soy, which was a product first introduced in the early years of the 20th century. But it also exists on a microscopic level, that scientific agriculturalists purposefully introduced bacteria strains from Germany in the early years of the 20th century that had the capacity to fix nitrogen in the soil. And you can't see the bacteria, but it's there in the ground. And if I look out my kitchen window into the backyard, I have an apple tree. So this tree is the descendant of trees that were imported, again, in the late 19th century. Apples are not indigenous to the Americas, and the late 19th century varieties were thought to be better than the earlier colonial ones. And many of the bees that pollinate that tree are also the descendants of late 19th and early 20th century immigrants. The most popular imported bees were Italian bees. That were characterized by a golden color, and they were thought to be superior to the native bees, which were described as dull black-colored bees that were more obstreperous and worse honey producers. So on all kinds of levels, we're talking about massive ecological transformations across the region.
Well, that's all the time we have for now. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us and sharing us some of the stories from your book.
Oh, Rob, thank you so much for having me.
That's Kristen Hogenson, professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She joined us to talk about her most recent book, The Heartland and American History.